Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information. Welcome back to Sea Dreams with An Vo, Phil Van, and Kenneth Nguyen. Today we're talking about the difference between common law and civil law and how it affects Southeast Asia, but I think we're going to take a few moments to really get into the setup of common law and civil law. An interesting question is how these legal systems affect the economic development, if at all, for the region. And as we posed this before in a previous episode, what kind of capitalism is likely to prevail in the long run? Will it be the more market-focused Anglo-Saxon capitalism or the more state centered capitalism of continental Europe and perhaps even Asia?
Common law started during the Middle Ages in the 12th and 13th centuries in England. It's based on case law and precedent rather than codified law represented in codes. If a judge is at an appellate level, the judgment's written down, and other judges can see how that judge made a decision to help form a consensus, because it's hard to create statutes to describe every possible legal situation.
Okay, can I stop you there? Yeah. Okay, so basically what you're saying is common law is based on precedents, right?
Yes.
Like what happened before,
right?
And when you start to kind of figure out what happens before, lawyers present this idea of, oh, that happened, therefore we need to make a decision now based on what happened before.
Yes and no. I mean, I think what it is, it's precedents is about the facts now have echoes to facts that happened before. And hey, what happened before was decided this way, right? And so the facts now are similar to the facts that happened before. So therefore, the judgment that came before should be applied to the facts now.
Got it. Okay. Right?
And so the judge was like, hey, there's a principle of stare decisis, which is effectively the decision from before should apply now, because the facts are very similar.
Okay, got it. All right, civil law?
So civil law started in the 6th century Roman Empire. It's older than common law, and it defines the legal system in European countries like Germany, France, Spain, Italy. It's based on the concept that everything can be turned into a code. Is it actually possible to think of every legal situation and codify it? Probably not in the past, but maybe in the future, with the help of computing power and AI, we can actually achieve this. The bigger question, as it pertains to our podcast, is does an inherited common or civil law system from European colonizers affect Southeast Asian countries differently, change the way they operate? And the more universal question beyond that, which a lot of scholars have debated, is do lawyers and judges in these systems, whether they're Asian, European, American, actually think differently? Does the legal system, the practice of common or civil law, change the way lawyers and judges process information and make decisions?
You know what's crazy? Before I embarked on the last episode with you both, I didn't even know that there was a difference. I mean, I knew it, like I heard about it, but it wasn't really pronounced in my mind. And you talk about this often, on is this idea that, you know, NPR or whatever public broadcast that we get, it's giving us like these little sound bites, right? It's not going to go into these deep dives. And for me, going into these deep dives and going into like the multiple rabbit holes that we're about to go down today is the most fascinating thing. And the most, you know, I'm learning so much between common and civil law, but it's just not, it just doesn't end there. There's bigger implications that Phil had brought up earlier that we're going to get into.
Yeah, I think in the general public discourse, you know, as you read newspapers, national newspapers or state newspapers, you watch the national news, you read or watch the Sunday opinion shows on TV, listen to NPR. I think that kind of discourse presumes a certain level of understanding that many, including myself, don't have. We may get the 5 or 10% of what's being talked about, but we don't get that deep understanding of the topic. And two, we don't understand how this topic here affects that topic over there, right? And so hopefully this podcast will help educate the audience as well as ourselves. So we're just as interested observers as you guys.
Yeah, because we're really looking at it at the high level right now between the two differences, but then it needs to trickle down and see how these regions are affected by the two systems. And ultimately, the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a really interesting kind of case study because Southeast Asia does have differences in which countries are common law and which are civil law, right? And there has differences in whether they were colonial, being colonized or not, right? And some had royal families and some didn't, right? And so this is a really interesting case and try to put a different lens on it, if you will. But Phil, which countries in Asia or Southeast Asia are common law and civil law systems?
Well, Malaysia is defined by common law, as well as Singapore and Brunei.
Okay, and these are because it came from the colonial British power, right?
That's right.
Okay,
yeah.
So anything that came from Britain is common law, right? Yeah. These countries.
Yep.
But how did common law develop? I know we talked about dates, but why did the British find the need to create common law and break away from the European society?
Well, so this is very, very basic, but in feudal times, it was the king and the churches effectively who held power, right? And so peasants and merchants would come to the king or the lord or the bishop and say and plead their case. Right. And so they would say, hey, someone stole my sheep. Right. Or, hey, someone destroys my fence. Hey, Lord, can you help me?
And
decide?
Then they had to codify the laws.
Yeah.
Okay.
They had to, the king or the bishop or whoever had to decide, like, oh, so this person was responsible for your loss. And therefore, this person should pay this amount. Right. And so this happened over and over and over again throughout the decades and centuries. And so as each case was decided, people would realize that, hey, these facts were similar to the facts that happened 5 months ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. Therefore, these facts now are very similar to those facts. Therefore, the decision should be made, should be the same or very similar.
So is that what the British did?
Yeah, that's what the British
okay,
did.
So they said now it's the same. We don't need to codify it. We'll just look back a few cases and okay.
Yeah. And then the civil law is basically saying, hey, the state, whether it's a ruler or whoever, a king or queen or the state itself, in Athens, it was the body, the Senate, essentially, saying, hey, the law should be this, right? And we understand, we think that we know every single thing that would happen, right? And in this situation, you do this. And so under civil systems, the parties and the state or the judge would say, oh, let's look at the statute or the code and can we find that specific situation? And then if we can fit these facts into that specific kind of legislation or code, then we have to do exactly what that code says, right? And so you can see from that example is that civil systems work really, really well when the facts fit the case. When the facts fit the code, right? But what if the facts don't fit the code, right?
We have an issue.
We have an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where common law sometimes has an advantage. Right, because it's much more flexible.
The list, the majority of Southeast Asian countries are operating under civil law, like Indonesia, Thailand, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Myanmar. Like civil law seems to be predominant throughout the region. That's by and large because of the colonial forces that interfaced the Dutch,
Germans,
the French.
Okay, I'm going to make a little observation here. But does it sound like Malaysia, Singapore, Brunei are more rich countries, and then the other ones are, I don't know, a little bit more poor or less GDP? I mean, is there something going on here with the ones that have the common law?
Well, in our Singapore episode, we discussed this a bit, just that, that common law was good for inducing trade and business relationships throughout Singapore, especially with like the oil industry and big business, because it's sort of respected internationally in a way that I guess the implication is in a way that civil law isn't, but we're really going to get into that a bit more, because I think there are misconceptions about the value of common law versus civil law. And a lot of those misconceptions come from a business-minded standpoint.
Yeah. Wow. Is it a business-minded standpoint or is it a cultural value standpoint in terms of, you know, if you think about Canada, US, Australia, Britain, all the Queen's derivative, right? I mean, is that even a word, a term? But the countries that are coming out of common law from the British are more prosperous. Is that a narrative or is that something that is really real?
Well, it all depends on which lens you look at this through, right?
Do we need to explain a few more building blocks till you get to that lens?
I think we do.
Okay,
we
but
do.
That's what looms
that
over.
Is a real interesting kind of question of this whole episode.
Yeah, that's where I'm resting my sort of like that.
Yeah, we're going to get to that little juicy bit of the meat. Right,
I'm teasing the audience.
Before we get there, it might be worth noting just that before colonization in Southeast Asia, all these countries had different legal systems that were pretty diverse. And they were all sort of replaced by either common or civil law. So just a quick rundown of what those were. Vietnam was ruled by a feudalist system, and there were written laws and codes, but within an authoritarian government in which the king of the Nguyen dynasty had absolute power through a hierarchy of officials. There's no separation of administrative or judicial power. Thailand was based on the Hindu code of Manu and was largely uncodified until 1932. Singapore, Malaysia were based on a combination of Malay customary laws and adat laws. Laos was governed by a monarchy that lasted for six centuries until 1975. Brunei was based on Islamic law. And the Philippines had a legal system based on customs, traditions, and usages, laws passed down orally, believed to be given by God. There weren't any formal legal institutions and no judges or lawyers. The elders of a community actually studied the customs traditions of their tribes to become consultants and advisors. Korea's legal system was based on customary laws and practices, and disputes were often resolved by kings, nobles, other officials. So you see a lot of like feudalism, a lot of monarchy-based legal systems.
Yeah, which is basically the rule is just based on what the king thinks is the law of the land, right?
Yeah.
There's not much to codify if you really think about it.
Which traditionally, and it's not in any way endorsement of colonization, but and the spread of the West, but traditionally, I think it led to more injustice
and less
fair treatment, less individual kind of cases heard on their own merits.
So then is the advent of colonialism a good thing for mankind throughout the world?
That's a evergreen question, right? And like I said, by no means should this podcast be an endorsement of, you know, colonization. But I think certain things came out of it that maybe spread democracy and a certain level of like legal rigor or fairness.
Colonialism is such a bad word. I mean, I use it in a very bad word way, right? Yeah. When I think about it. But then if you're saying that the majority of these guys were, you know, these lands were feudal monarchy, dictatorship, there's a lot of injustice. Colonialism probably brought a lot of justice to the table.
Danger, danger, Will Robinson. Yeah.
that's the quote on your tombstone, Ken.
I mean, I think if you think about,
he stood for colonialism.
I think if you watch Gladiator, things like that, you know, you could argue that the Roman Empire did great things for the world, right? Even though the initial invasion, you know, suppressed the tribes and whatever, it did give rise to a common language, if you will, a common set of measurements and common way of doing things and probably understanding the world. Anyway, we'll leave that for another episode. Yeah.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the Reproductive Rights Amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.
You earned a degree in the behavioral health field because you wanted to make a difference. And you're needed now more than ever. Through the new Great Minds Fellowship Program, recent Ohio graduates may be able to receive as much as $20,000 in student loan support when working full-time at a community behavioral health center. Apply before November 15th. To learn more about program eligibility, visit highered.ohio.gov. That's highered.ohio.gov.
That's
but
great.
I think one of the things that we do need to talk about a little bit more, and talking about this helps illuminate our discussion later on why it's important for South Asia and how it applies to South Asia, is the different aspects of common law versus civil law and how they differ. So one point of difference is the role of judges under common law. So under common law, each party, you know, the defendant and the plaintiff have their own sides or their own lawyers, essentially arguing on their behalf. And it's the judge that is impartial, listens to both sides and makes a decision, right? What Americans would understand is the umpire calling balls and strikes, essentially.
Yep.
So the umpire doesn't, quote unquote, doesn't have a dog in the game, right? He or she just hears arguments from both sides, then decides what the best kind of decision should be. And they have to give, usually under common law, the judge has to give a reason as to why he or she came to that decision, right? And that's where the stare decisis comes in. It's not only the decision, but the reasoning for the decision, which gets carried on into later cases with similar facts.
And that's call coming from the judge.
Yeah, that's what yeah. coming from.
And the judge is not there to really ask questions, is he?
Very, very seldom.
He's not there to do inquisition or to ask,
exactly.
Hey, what's the details on the case? He's not there to clarify anything. He's just there to have both sides present as much as they can. But who makes the decision?
Under common law, it's a judge, right? But under civil law, I think the judge, who can be seen as an extension of the state, right, takes a more active role in determining what the facts are and what the outcome should be, right? And so I think it's a more collaborative way of more collaborative, if you will, legal system.
But can the judge be entirely impartial in civil law? Because he's doing the inquiring.
That's one of the legal fictions of common law is that the judge is impartial, right? That they leave their biases at the door, right?
For common law.
Under common law.
Yeah. But what are you saying about civil law?
Civil law is like the judge will say, I am acting on behalf of the state, right? And the state interest is this, and the state's interest is finding what is fair for all.
So they're supposed to be impartial as well, that judge,
to some extent, yes. But the way they operate is, if they see a deficiency, then the judge will say, "Hey, what about this thing that you lawyer didn't figure out or didn't put forth?" Right. So they're much more active.
See, but that could be a slippery slope if you think about it, right?
Let me tell me why.
Let me go pay the judge. And then the judge will like lean one way, whether it's the defendant or the plaintiff, because he's not impartial, really. He can just fire off a line of many questions against the defendant's team, right? So there's room for shenanigans.
Are you arguing that under civil law, there's more room for corruption than under common law?
Hey, I'm just reading between the lines. This is just coming on. It's coming in my mind. If that one guy, the judge, is sitting there trying to ask questions about the case, and he he can lean in. I can go to you on, you're the defendant, the defendant side, and I can just keep firing away.
Yeah, but under the common law, you, on that same kind of analysis, under the common law, you, each party is really dependent on finding a good lawyer, right? If you find a bad lawyer, the judge is not going to say, hey, lawyer, you're deficient. You didn't bring this up, right? The judge will say, I know some of these principles that should be applied, but your lawyer isn't bringing it up. I don't need to bring it up, right?
So there's that weird,
So that's an interesting,
because that's right? Money. Now we're looking at who can afford the best lawyers inside of common law.
Yeah. So as much as you're kind of making a point that the judge can maybe influence the case in an undue way under the civil law system, that he couldn't in a common law system, An's making the point that if you can't afford proper representation in a civil law system, perhaps the judge is a bit more corrective, right? Rather than impartial. And maybe in that correction, more justice is achieved. So there is an interesting kind of counter argument, right? And it makes sense in certain respects that civil law is practiced in countries like France, right? In which the government is arguably very corrective in the lives of its population.
You know what we should do? I mean, this is going to be a funny exercise, but we should type in the most corrupt countries in Southeast Asia, legally corrupt, because then we can make some connection to civil law versus common law.
I wonder if you can.
Danger, Will Robinson.
I wonder if this is it might be like a value attribution error, right? Just because you know what they say, like correlation is different than causation, right? So
it could be a fallacy.
I think there'd be a lot of systemic issues that have led to the corruption of that country's legal system. And it may not actually be related at all to whether it's civil or common law.
We'll never know.
Yeah.
We'll never know. Will we?
I think the UN does have a corruption index too.
They do.
Right.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah. Yeah. I'm a simplistic minded guy. I'm going towards the most simplistic explanation for corruption.
Sure.
Is it civil? Is it common?
Interesting. Well, just not to muddy the water further, but it's worth noting some of the more modern research on common versus civil law. Like there were a bunch of researchers at Harvard led by Holger Spahman, a professor lawyer there. And he gave common law judges the same cases with different precedents set by other judges to see how these affected their judgments. In other words, if you have two judges, they both get the same cases, they both have to turn in judgment on them, and they have totally different precedents set by past judges. And to this research team's surprise, the precedents had very little effect on the judges' judgments. They discovered, by and large, that the judges were more inclined to look at the actual meaning and intentions and the parameters of the law as guidelines for judgment rather than the influences of past judgments in similar cases. Which is interesting because it suggests that common law judges don't operate that differently
than
civil law judges, mm-hmm. right? And that's further supported by just a quick look at the one civil law state in the U.S., which if you had to wager a guess, would you say it is?
I didn't know. No, wait, you're telling me there's one civil law state in the United States?
Yeah.
I did not know that. If I was to take a wild guess, I don't know, maybe Nevada or Louisiana.
You got it. Which one? Second try.
Louisiana.
Yeah.
I didn't know. The Louisiana Purchase.
Yeah. So thanks to Napoleon's influence, Louisiana is a civil law run state. And it was because he sort of sold at a discount price all this land to Thomas Jefferson. and with it came his sort of legal guidance, I guess, or influence. A lawyer named David Shine, who's also the dean at the University of St. Thomas, says that he's practiced on the ground in both Louisiana and Texas side by side. And the day-to-day reality of the common law system in a state like Texas and the civil law system in a state like Louisiana is negligible.
Oh, wow.
It almost doesn't matter at all. And that's because what a lot of, I think, lawyers and judges have found is that over time, common law practitioners have really started looking more at code, and civil law practitioners have started looking more at precedent, just because these are really smart lawyers and judges are really smart people, right? And they're not going to blind themselves to like the obvious benefits
of each system.
And so they've sort of met in the middle to an extent, at least as the in the United States.
It's a convergence, if you will.
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes sense, right? But you know, this Harvard study, how do they actually quantify the differences? You know, like there's
I don't know the test set. I don't know the pool.
Yeah.
And maybe if you spread it out over a bigger pool, you'd find different results. Obviously, results are always up for scrutiny. But
yeah.
But in whatever test set they ran this on, that was their finding.
Negligible.
Yeah. It's telling. That isn't to say that the civil law system in Southeast Asia is exactly the same as the common law system in Britain, for example. You know, I'm sure there are pretty dramatic differences when you spread it out over nations. But it is to throw a bit of a wrench in the spokes of the idea that these two systems diverge that much, and to suggest that in practice, I think ultimately there is a tendency toward justice and fairness in most legal systems, and to not over just blindly following the rules.
Yeah.
I think under common law, the justice is kind of found in principles in case law or previous case law, right?
Yeah.
Whereas in civil law, the justice is found in principles encoded in the legislation or the code. So I think both systems try to push this ideal, if you will, of what the law should be in these situations, certain situations. They just go about it in slightly different ways.
This is so interesting. I wonder why the whole world just doesn't say, hey, let's just bring both of these things together and just practice based on both these things being one thing.
Well, they kind of do. So when Phil talks about convergence, that kind of happens at the international level. So, for example, at the World Trade Organization, WTO, when countries have economic disputes, right, they do so in the WTO Trade Dispute Forum, right, where there's essentially a first hearing, and there's an appeal body as well. And so those kind of bodies draw from legal practitioners, lawyers essentially, and judges from constituent countries. It's worth noting that I think a lot of the practitioners, lawyers, come from common law countries, and there are some from civil law countries too. And that kind of speaks to which countries are very active in WTO disputes, right? So, for example, English-speaking countries are very active in WTO disputes. America, for example, et cetera, et cetera. So because they bring a lot more cases, you would imagine that they would have more lawyers who have lawyers, i.e. common law lawyers, who have represented clients before the WTO. So therefore, common law practitioners are more prevalent in WTO than civil law countries.
And I wonder, do people actually notice the difference in a lawyer that comes onto the WTO or the Hague or any of these international courts? Do you notice the stylistic difference of a Amal Clooney, for example? You know, I mean, I imagine she comes out of the common law system. Is there an actual sort of reverence for her because she came out of a common law? I don't know what system she came out of, but.
No, she's an English lawyer.
Okay.
So I'd imagine. I don't think that's the case. I think at that level, lawyers will respect other lawyers. What's more interesting, I think, is the kind of the attitude or the ethos behind common law systems versus civil systems, right?
Yeah, this is going to be a big thing.
Yeah, and I think for a lot of common law systems, there's this emphasis on property rights. Right, meaning what are the bundle of rights that I have which I can enforce against you, this other person, right? And so under common law legal systems, it's about adjudicating or deciding what rights belong to whom, and therefore whose rights were infringed upon, and therefore what kind of damages or remedies
I find that so
accrue to you.
I find it so difficult to understand why that is such a focal point in common law, not civil law. Why do you attribute that, what you just said, to common law, and why is it missing in civil law?
Because I think under the common law, it's about individual rights that accrue vis-a-vis as against the state. So under common law systems, it's usually the case that they want the state to not be as involved in the economy and leave the operations or the participation in the economy to individuals, companies, persons, right? And have minimal interference from the state. Civil countries see the state as paramount, right? And therefore they say the state's interest is supreme above all, right? And therefore it's not in the interest of the state to have this happen, right? Whatever it is, right? It's actually the state's interest. And the state represents the interests of everyone, right? Not of individual companies or persons.
So now does this correlate to political systems and political ideology as a result of civil and common law coming from, I mean, what you basically just described is individualism versus community, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And if we just break it down in terms of, like, really simplistically, reductively, even in terms of just fear, right? Like if you grow up and you have a fear of a state-run system, right? You're really afraid of big government. You're afraid of government intervention. You're taught that fear by your family. Maybe you're taught some lessons about the government taking things away from you, right? I think you would naturally hesitate to want to implement a civil law system or be a part of a civil law system. If you grow up afraid of individuals, particularly wealthy and or greedy individuals that run rampant on people of classes that are beneath them, right? And you, what you long for is intervention and equity. You long for a system that equalizes opportunity to an extent, then I think you would be more partial to a civil law system, and you'd actually be quite afraid or less partial to a common law system.
I wonder, I mean, it sounds like that makes sense, but to me, what about Britain? I mean, I'm sorry, India. India is a common law, but what about the caste system in India?
Well, so there's this, just, I want to step back here a little bit. There's this prevailing kind of lens on what to view or how to view economic development, right? And it was pushed by a group of legal scholars, Laporta, Lopez de Salens, Andre Schaefer and Schlieffe, and Robert Michener back in the, I think the 80s onwards. And which basically says that common law systems provide strong protections for investors. It protects property, right? And because it protects property and investors, those investors and property, they can flourish. And therefore, under a capital system, or capitalist system, or capitalist economy.
Common law is very appropriate for
very, it. Very appropriate. And therefore, that's why capitalist countries flourished and became economic powerhouses, let's say, post-World War II.
Do you guys agree with that?
Yeah.
Do you agree with that theory?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, just that common law is synonymous with the protection of investing and individual property mm-hmm. rights. Yeah, mm-hmm. definitely.
Accumulation of money, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, of course.
And that can, you know, that can manifest itself into things like the banking and finance regulations, labor laws, consumer protection laws, etc.
So is that the reason why common law predominantly richer countries have that system?
Quite possibly. I mean, it's maybe it's a bit of the chicken or the egg, right? But I mean, I think if you believe in less regulation and more investor protections and individual economic freedoms, typically you're headed toward common law, or you live in a common law system, or you attempt to, or you try to, you know, with your resources.
Yeah.
Is that good? Is that bad? I mean, you could judge it either way. I think
I would even take it a step backward when you ask that question: is it good or bad? I'm thinking, is this something that the writers of these laws, who instituted these laws, did they have this idea that let's build this so we can flourish, so we can take?
Well, no, because under the common law system, it's left up to individual investors and economic participants to decide what happens in the market,
so
what happens in the economy, right?
It's pretty sophisticated then, right?
What do you mean sophisticated?
It's very sophisticated. It's like, okay, well, look, we will back off and
we, meaning who?
The government.
The state,
yeah. Right? It's pretty sophisticated to say, we as the state will back off and let you flourish.
Yeah.
And let you do your thing.
Yeah, it's typically defined by like a population that wants the state to serve more as a night watchman.
I'll give you an example. 1800s US, you've got the oil barons, you've got the railroad barons, you've got monopolies and oligopolies, right? Where only a few people control the railroads, a few people control oil production, a few people control manufacturing, right? That, in your case, right, is a common law saying, hey, we're going to give supremacy to property rights and investor protections, etc. And therefore, you've got a few big companies or a few
big guys,
big individuals control the whole economy. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
That's a horrible thing.
Yeah.
Horrible thing.
Right.
Yeah.
So at some point,
who figured
what's good for the economy or the state, i.e. the economy being everyone in the economy, the state meaning everyone, right, in a nation or in a nation state, should benefit. That's a moral kind of
who figured it out?
Judgment, right?
Who figured how to break this up?
Well, in 1800s, 1900s US, the government came in and said, hey, you're too big, right? So they broke up Standard Oil, for example.
So we can't grow. Mom and pop shops can't grow. We don't have competition.
We don't have innovation.
We don't have innovation. Nothing's going to change. We're going to be stagnant for the rest of our history. Mm-hmm. So we got to break this up.
Yeah.
I mean,
it hurts market competition.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the U.S.
It's just it's basic anti-monopolization.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
In the U.S., there's a history of company towns, right? For example, mining towns controlled by one mining company. They have all the employees. The mining company requires all the employees to live on, you know, mining-owned housing. Go to shop in mining-owned grocery stores.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically it's the company forcing their employees to earn money, but then spend the money at company stores. And
the common law governments break all this stuff up, right? But in Asia, we don't break it up, do we? In Korea, we don't, they don't break it up.
Because under a civil system, the state becomes more paramount, right? Or more supreme. And so it kind of lends itself to more of a state hand forcing itself and making its presence felt in the market, if there is a market, right?
So like
Vietnam, Korea, South Korea.
South Korea.
Right, Singapore.
Wait, Singapore is a common law.
Yeah. Right, but I'm just saying this is under the Laporta thesis, where it's the main determinant of economic development in any country, right, is whether it's a common law system or a civil system, right? And under the Laporta thesis, it kind of downplays other factors such as politics. It downplays other factors such as history. It downplays other factors such as culture, right? And so for culture, for example, there are some cultures where they're not conflict averse. They're actually willing to, they're conflict, they prefer conflict, right? And so they, in these kind of cultures, conflict is seen as a good thing. And therefore they rush off to the courts to decide who wins and who loses, right? But there are other cultures, and especially in Southeast Asia and Asia more generally, where it's a more conciliatory approach, where they're conflict avoidant, right? They try to not have conflict. They try to solve things before the conflict arises, right? And so in that kind of way of looking at things, right, does common law and civil law factor into it, right? Maybe not, right? Because they try to do politicking or reputation or long-standing kind of relationships. They try to work through conflicts that way and not through a common law or civil law kind of system. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Singapore is a little confusing, right? Because if you look at its business relationships and its economy, common law makes perfect sense. But if you look at some of its government mandates, right, like the reacquisition of land, the government ownership of land, and then the giant sort of health and welfare fund for its population, it would seem more like a civil law nation. So there are these kind of contradictions implicit, I think, in any, it's what makes each country unique and distinct. I don't think it's a given based on either the economic status or the social kind of matrix layout of the country, whether or not it's a civil or common law system, which kind of might be a good segue into the onset, this Asian Development Bank article. That was really interesting because it sort of second guesses any connection between common and civil law and the economic prosperity of a country, right?
So it's saying, in plain English, it's saying that we should not attribute any success to common or civil law. It doesn't matter.
I wouldn't go as far as that. It just questions it.
Right? Okay.
And what's interesting, an interesting tidbit is that the Laporta thesis, right, is generally authored by Western scholars, right? The contradictory or the one that questions, the paper that questions this prevailing Laporta thesis is written by an Asian person, which is, I find very interesting, right? So it's like, hey, when you're viewing development, economic development in Southeast Asia, for example, don't look at it through the common law, civil law lens, because that's a very Western-centric kind of perspective to take or approach to take. You need to maybe question that and look at the biases inherent in your analysis previously. And it could be that culture plays an important part, politics plays an important part, language plays an important part. The attitude to conflict plays an important part. And these kind of factors or perspectives are kind of downplayed or dismissed under the Laporta analysis.
So. Yeah, the author's name is Meredith Wu Cumming. She wrote this article, this sort of data set in April 2001.
Yeah. 2001. And this is interesting. Yeah. This kind of topic isn't really discussed and it hasn't garnered that kind of intense kind of scrutiny in the last like 23 years. You know what I mean? It's kind of this perspective is not the one that captured the world kind of attention, but which is not to say that it isn't true or it isn't correct or isn't worthy of further scholarship.
Well, I think if we go back to this Harvard study that we talked about earlier, and we're saying that the two, we're saying that the results of the two systems is negligible, then, you know, maybe it doesn't really affect the outcome economically or the benefits that these two different laws are giving to the system of each country. It maybe has no effect. I mean, that's what we're here for, right? We're here to find out if it has it makes a difference in these societies.
I think so.
Well, it kind of does, right? Insofar as if you think about it, if you're trying to encourage further investment into Vietnam, for example, right? And you're trying to get that investment from Western countries, the US, Australia, France, Germany, England, into Vietnam. Whose kind of opinions do you need to kind of protect, right?
Or what does that have to do with civil and common law?
Well, if you're coming, if you're an investor from England, America, France, Germany, whatever, right? You want to know that your investment is protected.
Right, but don't you want, it doesn't matter what law we're practicing, we just want an enforced law. We want infrastructural integrity in the legal system that we're playing in. So if Vietnam was civil or common, didn't matter, but it has wonkiness in its legal system. Or when you think about Singapore, it has just brute strength built into its infrastructural legal infrastructure.
Well, yes and no. So in many international contractual agreements, the choice of jurisdiction is very, very important, right? So in international contractual agreements, there would be a clause which says, in the event of a dispute, the laws of this particular jurisdiction will apply.
Right.
And oftentimes it's
Singapore,
for example, Singapore or London.
Okay.
Right. So London's common law.
But that's Singapore. What I'm saying. Is it because it's common law or civil law, or is it because it's just bulletproof infrastructure?
It's a known quantity, right? So London legal framework is a known quantity, same as Singapore. So it's just certainty, as you said, right? It's certainty. And if you're an investor from London, from England, from America, from Australia, you'll be much more comfortable with a common law kind of choice of jurisdiction.
So if tomorrow Vietnam said, you know what, we want to play with the big boys, let's switch our legal system out and make it common law, they're still not going to get past the building blocks of the legal structures in Vietnam. They won't be able to enforce, they won't be able to carry out the known quantity that you said, right?
Well, yeah, that's when, like I said, the choice of jurisdiction clause comes in, right? To some extent, it can be, the legal risk can be assuaged by some of that, right? As far as in the event of dispute, we'll take it to a court in Singapore, or we'll take it to a court in London, right? Sometimes that can't be done. And it's like, oh no, the Vietnamese partner will demand it, you know, if it goes to a Vietnamese court. And in that instance, in negotiating the contract, would the American investor be interested in making that investment in the first place or not?
Just think about like how American investors view government intervention in the US, you know, paying taxes, for example, right? Regulation on big business.
Yeah.
Right. And how many millions of dollars added regulation, added taxation, even a small percentage can cost a big business, a big investor. And then think about how that would apply to like a civil law system, right? In which it's almost presupposed that the state will be biased toward itself or toward some sort of equity and fairness that is not necessarily in the best interest of big investment, right? And that I think might chase money away. It might chase big investors mm-hmm. away. And it may not be as dialectic as specific and cut and dry as this. But I think even the presupposition that civil law may not have big investing in its best interests, right? Could shift the economic sort of narrative.
Yeah. Right?
And so I think just getting back to like this, Meredith Wu Cummings paper. So she sort of starts from the mindset that the proponents of common law consider it superior, but the proponents of common law are often either kind of very money-minded conservative or neoliberal investor types who are seeding a certain narrative that this system should be dominant and should be omnipresent because it allows them to push their
agenda.
Very westernized agenda. Yeah. And is is that sort of against the sort of better, I don't know, the will of the people, right? Or what's best for the people? That's a question.
You've been building this case all night, and I think that's it's a fair question, but I'm having trouble connecting it. I'm having trouble seeing the agenda of capitalism, common law, and civil law. I'm having trouble saying the West is out-muscling legally their way into these regions. Is that what we're getting at?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's difficult to discuss because what Meredith is saying is that this is a myth. It's not true. That the notion that a common law system is synonymous with bigger business interests and better opportunities to make money and for an economy to flourish is a myth sort of perpetuated or propagated by practitioners and supporters of common law systems, largely white people from the West.
Yeah.
Right.
Who have a vested interest in that narrative. Right.
But see, is it a legal
the
question?
The winner writes the history.
Yeah.
What Phil is saying.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, because I'm the big investor coming in, I must know something more than you do, right? And I think that's somewhat dangerous, I think, right? Because if it's like colonialism all over again. It's a white man coming in and saying, I know more than you. I know more than you for what's best for your country.
I gotta push back a little bit. Just something inside me doesn't sit well with that.
Yeah,
it doesn't. Is it the white man? Is it the colonial powers, or is it just an accumulation of time in gray, time in service to this like advanced legal system that they've got it down to where they can push around the civil law people, the civil law countries. And it's not an issue of white or colonialism, but is it an issue of just, hey, they perfected this way of doing business through law. And it just happens to be superior to this other side in Southeast Asia or Vietnam or Thailand and all these other countries. Yeah. And is it a myth? I think this is the crux of our discussion today.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, that's kind of the, maybe it's a wrong question to ask, right? It's not a case of whether the common law system is the best system to use in mercantile trade, right? For me, it's, if you're looking at economic development, it's a question of how do I best set up the systems and the institutions to best allow for an opportunity to develop my economy, my nation state, right? And if you're trying to woo big corporations to come in from common law countries, then they would be happier if your country, your nation state practice common law kind of principles and legal system. If you're trying to attract civil law system investors from Germany, from France, for example, they'll get greater kind of comfort, if you will, to invest their monies if your nation state kind of adhered to a civil law system. For me, I think that question is kind of like illusory insofar as for a nation state to develop, it should do what's in its best interests, right? And it has to decide for itself what its boundaries are, as in what it will accept or not accept, right?
But it's still not, you guys are still not addressing the heart of the question. And what we're talking about is white man, colonial, common law system, is it more advanced, is it a better system, and therefore it thrives all over the world, in England and United States, Australia, Canada, because it's an actual advanced system, or because the victors are white and they won and they now control the legal movement?
It's an incredibly complicated question, right? So there's all these different parts to it, but like what you're saying effectively is like, is capitalism a better system than socialism in a way, right? But
sure.
But you're also not saying that, because we can't assume that common law is capitalism and that civil law is socialism.
Sure.
No matter how many nations sort of line up with that assumption.
Yep.
And I think kind of Meredith's point in this paper really is that
it's complicated.
It's very complicated, and there isn't a direct relationship. You can have a flourishing, highly capitalistic economy under civil law, right? And the presumption that you can't might be something perpetuated by people with private interests that that
is she saying that too?
She is. Okay. Yeah. So yeah. So, but
Singapore is a case in point, right?
But yeah, exactly. But maybe just for the sake of argument, just for simplification's purposes, right? We just assume that there is a direct correlation, right? And that what we're talking about is actually what we're talking about, and that is that we suspend disbelief for a moment, and we assume that. If you have a common law system, like in the US or in Great Britain, you're basically participating in a far more capitalistic system, or late capitalistic system, right? And if you have a civil law system, you're pretty much on the side of big government, tons of intervention, tons of social services, right? Tons of help for the lower and middle classes, and less incentives for the rich. That's not true, just to be clear, right? That's not
a
textbook truth, mm-hmm. and there are many, many exceptions to this. It's not a rule, it's a hypothetical. But if we kind of codify the hypothetical and we say, okay, this is the argument we're having, right? Which system's better? Then you've really got to ask yourself, like, what happens when every civil law nation takes on common law practices? I mean, we live in a time, as An was saying, of robber barons. It's remarkable, actually. I was having this discussion with Dan Truong, shout out, last night. But, we robber barons were sort of a thing of the past, or there is a sense of antiquity.
They're here.
If you look at a list of robber barons, right, you've got guys like Hearst, for example, and then you've got like Zuckerberg or Elon Musk. It skips almost 100 years.
Bezos,
and they're in Bezos, sure, and they're all. It's we're in an era of robber barons once again.
Yeah, 2.0, because we haven't adapted the laws to this new stuff yet.
Yeah, because the old robber barons were national; they're within a national boundary. Yeah. Right. Whereas in new robber barons, the Facebooks is worldwide. The Bezoses of the world are worldwide. Yeah.
And they had no time back in the Robert Barron's time, Standard Oil, they didn't have people to break it up when it was happening.
Yeah.
And it's happening now.
Right.
And but are we breaking it up?
Well, big boy, that's a great question. I mean, technology got ahead of regulation.
Way ahead.
It was to the government. The internet was a series of tubes, and no one understood that Facebook was going to be like basically a vertical monopoly, and no one understood that it could affect the outcome of nation states.
That's where my concern about the common law system kind of comes from, is that if it's a pure common law system where it's protection of individual rights or corporate rights, right, and protection of investor rights, then where does the state come into it? Where are the interests of the state, right? Where does the interests of the people who are the subjects of this economy that's being foisted upon them, where are their interests being kind of pushed or spoken for? That's my question.
I worry about a system that caters to the top 1%. And that that's aligned with the wealthiest business interests.
But don't you think
I understand that it affects the outcome of an entire country?
But don't we think that that's happening, has been happening in Southeast Asia for the last 200-300 years? That there is no protection that we have in the United States in the common law world. I mean, obviously we had protection right after the robber barons, but because we're living in a new age right now with Bezos and Elon, and so it hasn't caught up yet. But in Asia, the barons have existed for centuries, and people have to live under those rules of these big mega, you know, in Vietnamese we call it daika, but in Chinese and Korean it's the same word, you know, these big
tribals.
Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know if it's a legal system that's really responsible for any of this
but,
stuff.
But the tribals in Korea, South Korea, they're kind of work hand in glove with the government, right? There is strong government hand in the economy in South Korea. Even though there are oligopolies in South Korea, right? You can't say the same thing in the US, for example.
Yeah, though, you're right.
Right? So there is something to be said about state intervention in the economy, right? And therefore, you know, under a civil system that may give more protection to the state and therefore the citizens within a state than what a common law system would. But the thing is, I think again, like the ADB, Asia Development Bank paper puts out is, maybe it is too narrow of a lens to look at economic development in purely common law or civil law terms. The dismissal of things like politics, things of colonial history, things of culture, for example.
I think it has to be factored in.
It has to be factored
in. It doesn't make any sense to not.
Yeah, especially in Southeast Asia, where it's such a confluence of
so many factors,
so many individual peoples. Even within a nation state, right?
So I know this is probably off the topic, but is the world a better place today? You know, with all of the barons and all of the new tech barons that we have today, is the world a better place? And if it is a better place, especially here in the West, is it going to be just as good for the people in the East?
There's this school of thought that's coming to the fore, if not coming to the fore in recent years, where the thought previously in 20, 30, 40 years ago was that, you know, there's a first world and a third world essentially. Yeah. And if the third world does the right things and puts in the right
institutions, they become the first world.
Yeah. And it puts in common law, civil law systems, then they'll eventually come into the first world. And I don't think that's the case. I think there will always be winners and losers. There will always be a hierarchy, whether it's within your family, within your school, within your company, within the nation, within the international community of nations, right? There will always be a hierarchy.
But in the modern world, when you cross over from being a developing country like the way Taiwan or Singapore did it, do you ever go back? You don't go back, right? You don't really, in the modern world, you don't really go back. Vietnam is not probably going to go back. Right?
I don't think so. And I think, you know, progress is constant, right? But it comes with its trade-offs. We talked about the feudalist systems that kind of dictated the law in all the Southeast Asian countries we've been discussing. And we look at like the kind of common civil law debate discourse as something that now has replaced any sort of talk about the injustice under feudalism. And the question there is that progress? And I'd say overwhelmingly that there's probably more justice in a lot of these places,
because you're
more. Not your fate if you get in legal trouble is not dictated by like a king or his serfs, you
know? Yeah.
But so the next wave of all this is you know, technology, you know, being the next industrial revolution and all of the kinds of debates and problems that come with that. Is that progress? I still think it's progressive, you know, but I'm sure there are people in a cobalt mine that would disagree with me, you know, or farming through environmental waste in some sort of a dump site in India that could present a pretty compelling argument to the opposite. So it's just like that. It's evergreen. It's an eternal debate.
Yeah.
Like progress comes with its costs. Is it progress? I think technically it is. You know, we're not living under monarch rule great.
No, but I mean, quantifiably, are we living better lives, right? All over the world, you know, in America, Southeast Asia, is it a better world today?
It's all a matter of perspective. I mean, look at the supply chain, right? We can get anything from anywhere. Yeah. We can cook anything we want in you know, from any country. That's extraordinary.
Yeah.
I think someone in a feudalist system with just a you know, purely local supply would say, oh my God, that's a miracle.
Yeah.
But it comes with, you know, it comes with, pesticides and, odd chemicals,
right?
And, and we, you know, we have to deal with all kinds of microplastics in our food, and we may all die of some sort of cancer before we're 60. So yeah, there are trade-offs, right? Like, it's really hard to purely, quantify and judge in terms of value.
So, what we have concluded here, can we agree that we can't say to a generic Southeast Asian country now that in order to economically develop into a first world country, for example, or economically develop from what you are now, that you definitely have to adopt common law, or you definitely have to adopt civil law, and only until you do, right, you will be guaranteed this economic development up until the first.
Yeah, moment. I don't think we can ever agree on that. Yeah. Like, you can't say do this or this, and then you will be coronated the next first world. Like, I think that's impossible.
All right.
So it's not about civil or common law.
All right. So if it's not about that, then what are the secrets to success then for Southeast Asian countries?
That's a great question. Making the legal system bulletproof. How do you do that? And I asked our dear friend Lun many years ago, because I said, you know, we want to make movies and we go back and we want to do this. He goes, okay, in Vietnam or anywhere in Southeast Asia, we got to handle criminal law first. And then you handle corporate law. Those two things need to be first in place, and it has to be really strong.
And then can you repeat that for those in the back?
Yeah. Criminal law and commerce, like commercial law, like business law, right? Mm-hmm. Those two things are like the bedrock. I'm paraphrasing grossly.
So what are you saying? Criminal law is basically saying, hey, anti-corruption, right?
All of it. Like, you do bad, you go to jail. It's mm-hmm. not about marital law or entertainment law or any of that. It's, or real estate law. Let's handle criminals first. So sure. That needed to be strengthened. And then once we can strengthen that, we work into commercial law. And he said something like, there's like, if you think about it, you can break it down into 12 to 14 categories. You know, of course there's more, but 12 to 14, you can get that situated. And then we go from there. But you can't even get criminal and commercial law handled first. And this is maybe 15 years ago, I talked to our friend Lun about this. And then today, as I think about how Vietnam and Southeast Asia is developing, like Taiwan and Hong Kong and Vietnam and Singapore, these countries have varying degrees of a bulletproof legal structure. That's where I think success is. It's not in common law or civil law.
That's an illusory choice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's in how bulletproof can you make the infrastructure?
And how much certainty you can give
certainty.
To investors.
Yeah, because you look at Mexico. You can't give Mexico, you can't give that certainty, right? It's
But this certainty, where does this certainty come from though? Like, when you say
touchy.
When you say bulletproof,
right? Where does that come from?
That means like, oh, the justice system, right, or the legal system is unimpeachable.
Okay, this might lead
is that politics? Is that this culture? Might what is
lead,
that?
This might lead into our next episode. Religion in the region. I don't know. Does the Judeo-Christian religion or religious aspect dictate how bulletproof your legal system is?
You have 300 million Muslims in Indonesia.
Yeah, but so what are you saying?
Well, you can't ignore them.
Yeah, what are you saying? What are you saying about Indonesia and the Muslim system? How bulletproof is Sharia law? How well thought out is it for business? corporate law, for criminal law. What if this is an issue that it's East West, or, you know, what?
I don't know if there's a relation. I mean, Christianity's predominant in Mexico, right? So if you draw a correlation between religion and economic success,
I would argue about this, about Mexico and Christianity, the way it's practiced in Mexico. I'm going to get myself crucified here.
Danger,
no pun intended.
Okay.
This is Sea Dreams. Southeast Asia podcast.
Yeah. Why you got to bring Mexico into this? Okay, this is my very simplistic observation about Catholicism in Mexico, okay? You got cartel guys all wearing rosary beads, right? The mafia of the United States, the Italian mafia, were all Catholics. All those guys were like making the sign of the cross. I'm going to kill you. And I'm going to go to penance. I'm going to go into confession, and I will wipe my sins clean. That's the way Catholicism works. That's how it works. I'm going to get rid of you, and I'm going to
absolution
of sin. Hey,
I can do the most heinous crimes as long as I go along to go to confession at the church on Sunday. I'm all golden.
Why did the Italian mob, why were all those guys Catholics? And why are the Mexican cartels, a lot of them wore rosaries? It's a Catholic country. They believe in the absolution of sins. So that's got probably a lot to do with the religion, the cultural vibe of like...
But there were also Jewish mobs in London, for example.
What about the Yakuza? I mean, what about like other... There are so many mobs. Every culture produces a mob, right?
Yeah.
All probably under a different religious.
But then
banner.
They got the bulletproof mobs, and then they got the weak mobs.
Triads.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. What makes
the Buddhist gangs in Thailand?
What makes a good mob? You know, what makes a good legal infrastructure? What culturally produces works of structure? I'm interested in that now.
It's hard because it feels like, again, a correlation causation.
Yeah, I get it. We're like simplifying shit too much. Yeah, I get it.
But it's easy to create a hypothesis and then find evidence to support it, right?
you can do it
with a lot of things.
I think we're just trying to edutain.
Yeah. You trademarking that?
Edutainment.
This is edutainment,
your
right?
LinkedIn, your edutainer.
I think this is interesting because... You know, we don't profess to be experts in anything.
Yeah, and I'm going to go even further with what you just said. I've always come from this like weird place where if I'm the dumbest guy in the room, then I'm all right. So I'm allowed to like make these dumb, simplistic. And you know, I admit to all of this sort of simplistic, but we cannot create these causal correlated relationships, right, with these theories. But you asked me a simple question: Mexican cartels, like what's up with that? It's, you know, I think a lot of this is religion.
Well, I was saying it just to sort of deflate the argument.
Yeah.
That, you know,
I get it,
that a certain religion leads to economic prosperity, because I don't totally buy that, like there's a direct correlation between like a you know, Judeo-Christian, a sort of Western America and the reason why America's prosperous. I think there are too many factors. It's too systemic. And I think you could find so many examples to the contrary, right? You could find billionaires in China or Vietnam or Singapore that are completely from a different religion.
Yeah, you're right.
Have a totally different ethos
right.
That have what it takes to such a wealth mindset.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. But I think for the United States,
right,
this is just my observation. We have Christianity, and then we pair that with Manifest Destiny, pair that with this wild open West. And I think the three of those things getting combined together propels the United States in the last 200 years. Right? So it's beyond just, well, it is Christianity, because our Christian God said, go West, and it's your Manifest Destiny to conquer the world, basically, to really be numero uno on this planet.
That's a very American view of the Bible, though.
Yeah,
right. It is, but
very American view of the Bible.
But is that not coming from religion? That America has that like outlook. I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying Manifest Destiny We have wide open west land. We go west and we just keep building the hell out of this.
But America was never really Catholic.
I never said Catholic. I said Christian.
What we've concluded today is that one way to look at economic development is through a decision, if you will, on whether common law systems would benefit more than civil law systems. I think what we've concluded as a threesome today is that that decision is not determinative
of success.
Only determinative of success for Southeast Asian countries.
There are other
factors at play, such as politics, history, culture, that may also lend its hand to an explanation of how to succeed. And therefore, there is no one prescription that we can apply to a generic Southeast Asian country that will lead to success without fail. And I think we need to look at it with a more open eye and explore in future episodes how some Southeast Asian countries have been able to succeed and how other countries can, Southeast Asian countries can look at those shining examples and replicate that success.
Awesome. Thank you, An. Phil, you have any closing words?
Yeah, that's a great summary. I think, if someone is more a proponent of civil or common law, there are probably pros and cons for both. But if anyone is sort of hinging the success of a Southeast Asian country on its legal system, then they're probably banking too much on the qualities and aspects of the legal system that are more or less just a small part of the equation when it comes to the prosperity or struggle of the country.
And I think your point much earlier on in this episode about the convergence of legal practitioners to, if you're there from a common law tradition of looking towards what civil law practitioners are doing and vice versa. That happens a lot at the international level, at the world trade level, for example. And that lends itself to a convergence which benefits, you know, a country in Southeast Asia, regardless of whatever civil system or common law system they apply.